This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The 2014 World Cup raised the hopes of the disabled and redefined how people look at technology when a paraplegic man in a robotic exoskeleton gave the first ceremonial kick to start the World Cup event. Controlled with just the man's mind, the suit may end up redefining how we think about humanity. The mind-controlled exoskeleton is the brainchild of Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. He is the director of the Nicolelis Lab at Duke University and Medical Center. Well, what questions do you have about this amazing new state-of-the-art technology? Where would you like to see it end up? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. With me in the studio to talk about the exoskeleton and mind-controlled machines, Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. Welcome to The Source.
Oh, hi. Thank you for the invitation.
So here you are. This was your native Brazil, and we had the exoskeleton right there in front of all your fellow Brazilians, and that was quite an event. Was that the kickoff of showing everyone what this thing could do?
Yeah, that was the intention, original intention, to showcase the, you know, science can be present in any part of our lives, any event. And since this is the biggest sport event in the world, we thought that it would be only appropriate to demonstrate this new technology for rehabilitation right on the soccer pitch of the opening game.
So it works because it's mind control, and that's really the big breakthrough that you are presenting, the interface between the brain and machine, right?
Yeah, there are two major breakthroughs. One is exactly what you mentioned, the fact that the patient can learn to use his or her own brain activity to control the movements of the device. And so the patient imagines that he wants to walk and the device follows the instruction coming from the brain. But also there's a second major development that was the possibility of the device sending feedback information to the upper body of the subject. So he could actually feel what is to walk on a soccer field and kick the ball. So Giuliano, the patient who kicked the ball, not only he made the movement of the exo to kick the ball, but he told us that he actually felt the contact, you know, for the first time in 6 years, he could feel something coming from his foot.
So he has the tactile, maybe temperature, all the things that you would need to have if you were going to, you know, if you have an arm, you know, my own arm operating in my life every day, it needs to tell me how tough I am gripping something so I don't shatter a glass or squish a hamster or something.
Exactly. That's the whole idea. So these sensors that we created, we call artificial skin. It was created in Germany by a good friend of mine, Gordon Chang, at Technical University of Munich. He had the ability to give tactile and temperature feedback to the arms of the subject. So Giuliano was wearing a special shirt, which had these micro-vibrating elements on the sleeves. So the sensors that capture the information from the surface of the foot or the knee or the hip were broadcasting this information to these micro-vibrating elements. So he was getting tactile feedback on his arm skin, and his brain was basically generating the illusion that that was coming from his own legs. So he actually had the sensation that he was walking by himself and kicking the ball by himself.
So this is amazing technology, and how soon will something like this be available to help the average person who is suffering from paralysis?
Yeah, that's the long-term goal, of course. We went through this first prototype. We're already building a second prototype from, you know, based on what we learned with these patients and over the last year of work. So we are hoping, and there are many other, I should say, there are many other exoskeletons coming out, you know, in the U.S., in Europe, so even in Asia. So we are hoping that in the next 5 years or so, we are going to start seeing a variety of applications for a variety of neurological disorders. In fact, we just published a paper showing similar technology for Parkinson's disease. And that is also coming very quickly because there was already about 55 patients around the world that tried this technology, and it seems to work to alleviate the tremors and to facilitate the locomotion of patients with Parkinson's disease. So I think we are going to see a lot of applications in the next few years.
Okay, our phone lines are open, and if you've got a question about this amazing technology, building exoskeletons that are controlled by the brain, and it's actually, you know, the brain-machine interface is, that doesn't work? Okay. All right. So we'll, the headphones are not working, but we're going to get that fixed for you when we go to this break. So let me ask you this question, Doctor, about this is just scratching the surface of this technology. I mean, because, yes, it's fantastic that you can control a robot with your mind and stuff, but this, you could do so much more with this. Where do you see this going?
Oh, yes, you're right. This is just the beginning, I think, because it took us 10 years of animal work, you know, to get here. You know, it was a long process to just develop the means and the technology to read brain signals and then, the, of course, the robotics to get this working. But I see this going beyond medicine. I think the first wave of applications will happen in neurology and to treat neurological disorders. But with the advent of non-invasive techniques, I hope that one of these days you'll be able to basically control your computer just by thinking. You know, you'll be basically interacting with your operating system in a remote machine using the virtual reality tools that we create to train patients and the technology to basically use brain-derived signals to control applications in your computer or apps or what have you. So there will be a full generation of brain-actuating technologies that will come for all of us, not only for disabled patients in the future.
Right. But the thing is about the way that you're able to decode the brain. And so you're using a non-invasive technique. You're not putting electrodes into the brain, although that was how you started out with animals.
Yes.
But now it's down to have a skull cap that is just covered with little silver dots. Each one is a sensor that is able to pick up on the micro electronic signals that come from the brain.
Yeah, that's what we did for the exoskeleton, yes. It's a non-invasive method that is well known. It's called electroencephalography, EEG, but now EEGs have become portable and even wireless. So you can be in a soccer stadium and broadcasting brain signals like we did with 75,000 crazy soccer fans screaming and using their cell phones and, you know, doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, there's all sorts of EMF all over the place.
Absolutely. That's one of the major concerns. You had all the TVs in the universe in that stadium broadcasting the game to the whole planet, and we were afraid of the interference, and it didn't happen. We measured, of course, weeks before we did some trials in some soccer games in Brazil, and the technology is so robust now that you can actually filter all that out, all the cell phones, all the electromagnetic noise generated by TV broadcasting and radio broadcasting. So with the improvement of this non-invasive technology, you start dreaming about these applications for regular people.
Right.
And we have lots of ideas. We have already done lots of things in animals. You know.
All right. We're going to be talking about those ideas. It's fascinating. The sky is the limit as we talk about bridging the gap between mind and machine, a new era of robotics and exoskeletons, giving people like almost superpowers. Give us a call if you've got questions. Number is 210-614-8980. We'll get to the phone calls when we come back from this break. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. What if you suddenly lost the use of your limbs through a catastrophic event or a disease, a condition? Would you now be totally incapable of helping yourself? Well, new technology is in the offing. It's coming around soon that could allow your brain to control robot arms and robot legs and suddenly allow you to be able-bodied once again. That is the life work of Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. He is the director of the Nicolelis Lab at Duke University Medical Center, and he has been working on some incredible discoveries in this area. He will be speaking tonight at the San Antonio Country Club, courtesy of the Mind Science Foundation. For more information about this, you can go to our website, tpr.org. We have a link there. Or you can go directly to the Mind Science Foundation's website, and there's also information about their other fascinating upcoming events. Let's go to the phone lines. If you want to join the conversation, ask a question. We want to hear from you, 210-614-8980. Jonathan has called in. Jonathan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Dr. Miguel Nicolelis about the prospects for, well, since I was very young, I could always hear some sort of music or something in my head, some sort of melody. I found out that's called audiation. And later, when I grew up, I considered inventing a device that could actually just take the, you know, the imaginated audio and put that into a speaker without having to learn an instrument, without having to go through hours and hours of practice. You could just, from one, you know, the direct imagination, you could just hear what someone was thinking. And I just wanted to know what kind of, if that could be a reality within my lifetime, because that's something I really thought about pursuing and devoting my life to when I was younger. And I think that would be nice for the world to have. So,
Jonathan, that's a great question. Yeah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate that. So, Doctor.
Well, that will take a little longer, but the principle is exactly what we are talking about here. You know, we have our patients imagine some kind of motion that they want to perform, and what we try to do is to pick up that electrical signal that is underlying the production of the motor commands in the brain to actually being able to generate a movement using a robotic device. The closest I can come to the particular issue that we had Jonathan ask is there is a now work starting on trying to synthesize voice from patients that cannot speak anymore because of a stroke or something that happened on the left hemisphere of the brain, try to use the right side, which has some speaking capabilities left, to see if you could actually restore the ability of patients to communicate by using a brain-machine interface. So that's something that I just saw some people talking about, and one of our colleagues is trying to do it in monkeys, because monkeys vocalize too. So he's studying the possibility of creating a brain-machine interface for vocalization.
But you could also have a piano and just imagine what notes you want to play and interface with that.
In theory, that could be true. But is, you know, there are some signals that are more straightforward to pick it up, like generating motions or movements of your own arms or legs. This is something that now we know how to do. As you get more elaborate and you know more complex functions, it becomes more difficult to pick up these signals, particularly if you're using non-invasive technology.
Okay, back to the phone lines. Sandra is on the line. Sandra, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. The reason I'm calling is because I work at a rehab hospital here in San Antonio, and they had the machine here. They were testing it out with a patient who was probably about 20-something years old. And it was just amazing to see him walk on that machine. And it actually did help him quite a bit. And he went home. He's coming back to be an outpatient here at Warm Springs. And it's just amazing to see him just walking on his own now.
All right, Sandra. Thank you for that call. Doctor, as you work with patients and, you know, they are paralyzed and they get into the exoskeleton and are able to get up and walk around and feel things that they haven't felt in a long time, what's their reaction?
Oh, basically both the patients and the rehab team, the first time we saw the first patient walk in our lab with this device, and he told us that he was feeling the ground. And because of the particular type of tactile feedback that we are generating, he was referring to us that he felt like he was back walking on grass for the first time in 8 years. Everybody, you know,
they could bring tears to your eyes.
Everybody. I mean, everybody broke down. It was a mixture of elation and emotion, both the patient and all of us. You know, we have people in this team that work with patients for 30 years, very experienced physicians and rehab personnel. Nobody could hold it. It was one of the greatest moments of my career. Even though I'm a basic scientist, I worked 30 years, in a basic science laboratory. When I went to medical school 30 years ago, that's what I one day thought, you know, basic science could do. So I couldn't hold it myself. You know, it was very, very touchy.
So let's go back to when you first had the idea that this is what you wanted to do. This was your goal, to build a exoskeleton that would help people who were paralyzed get up and get around.
Yeah, well, when I started 30 years ago, I wanted to study how brain circuits operate. That was the reason that brought me from Brazil to the U.S. 30 years ago. And I met a great guy in Philadelphia, John Chapin, that was my advisor as a postdoc. And John also wanted to do this, and we are the two only guys in the country that the first time we proposed this in a meeting, they thought we had lost our marbles.
Because you were too far ahead of everybody.
Well, I don't know that. It's just that the idea sounded too sci-fi for a scientific meeting. You know, but John and I started working slowly, and by the late 90s, when I moved to Duke, 94, we basically realized that we had got the first steps done, and we could move it. And it was in 1999 that John and I published the first paper in rats, suggesting that an animal could control a robotic device. And that paper was a hit instantaneously. It was all over the news. It was all over the world. And
it went platinum.
It went crazy. It went pretty crazy. And it was exactly the paper or the study that people told us would never get done. 10 years before, people told us, this is crazy. It will never happen. Well, a year later, my lab at Duke reproduced that study in monkeys. And that's when John and I said, oh, no, we could build a robotic vest. That was 2000. We could build a robotic vest controlled by the brain. And again, people said that we had lost our marbles somewhere. But that's when it started. So it was 14 years ago that we had the first theoretical conclusion that could be done. And it took all this time just to make it happen.
So when you see something like the Marvel movie, Iron Man, does that seem like something that, I mean, not flying around and stuff, but a functional suit that would be able to, someone would be able to wear and not be so cumbersome? Because I've seen the things that you had, and they're very large and hydraulics
right now,
and stuff.
Yes, yeah, that's the first prototype. It's like the first prototype of a cell phone. You remember, right, when we had those big bricks.
And my back still hurts from carrying
from carrying the bag that we had to carry, yeah. Yeah, but we is usually technologies like that, technology developments like that, you over-engineer the first version to make sure that it's safe and it can do what you expect it to do. But then you interact, like we did, with these 8 amazing patients, and they told us what we need to have and what we don't need to have, what is superfluous, what is fundamental. We are already building the second prototype that is going to be half the weight. Is going to have half of the hydraulic generators because we don't need the power that we thought we needed. It's not necessary for what they want to do.
And there's also a possibility of application for able-bodied people to have them so that they would have extra lifting abilities.
You may be talking very soon in a show in a few years of neuro augmentation or augmenting the realm of our, or the range of our perceptual or motor capabilities, for regular people like us.
Sure. That's a very theme a lot in video games and stuff.
Yes, there's a lot of things in entertainment, but I'm talking really about very important regular applications of, you know, interacting with your computers without keyboards, without voice recognition, just by thinking and other things like that.
So as you look into people's brains, how different are people's brains? Can you just put a different person into that same suit and that suit's going to react the same way?
At that level, yes. You can. That suit can be worn by anybody. There is a training period, of course. The person has to learn to produce the correct brain signals to stand, walk, and let's say kick or turn. Giuliano and the other patients, after 9 months, they're doing things we never thought they would be capable of doing. They got to exquisite capability of controlling the device that we didn't predict. So, of course, different people will have different skills and will be better at different things, but this suit is designed to work with, you know,
and
anybody.
Then the brain is such a plastic type of organ that it learns through biofeedback.
Yes, and that's what I mentioned to you in the beginning. The fact that we had such a rich tactile feedback changed the equation dramatically because every one of these patients, when the exo reached the maximum velocity that it can move, they all told us, we don't feel the exo anymore. We feel like we're walking by ourselves. So we fooled the brains of the patients to experience that they were walking by themselves. There was no machine there anymore for the brain's points of view.
So let's switch over to the philosophical channel here. I mean, how does this change the self, the sense of self, the definition of self?
I think this is the key question, the key basic question that we address in this research. What we are suggesting, and I have been publishing papers about this for almost 20 years now, is that the sense of self can expand to incorporate all the technology that we use on a daily basis and that we become proficient in using. So our cars, our phones, our clothing, our basketballs, golf clubs, rackets, tennis rackets, all these, for the brain's point of view, if you're good at, if you practice, it becomes an extension of our body, our sense of self.
So if I say I'm in a chair in one location, undisclosed location, some bunker, but I'm controlling a robot that is under the sea or in a burning inferno or something, where is the self? You know, I'm feeling everything that is there.
Your self goes all the way to the last layer of atoms of that robot and the intersection between that and whatever environment that the robot is at. So if you I describe in my book what my theoretical experiment is, very similar to what you said. I would be on the beach in Brazil controlling a robot in on the surface of Mars, roaming around whatever red sand mountain there. My sense of self would be at that place.
Right. So, but back here to the here and now and the reality and the hardware of it. I mean, who would Medicaid pay for this stuff? How is this happening?
Well,
how do we get it into people's hands?
That's a good question. I don't know here in the United States, but in Brazil, what I got from the president of Brazil and the minister of health there is that if the technology comes to a point that we hope it will, because Brazil paid for this development down there, not only for the World Cup demonstration, but for a whole research program, a collaboration with 156 scientists around the world. 25 countries are involved, and most of us are donating our time. But the senior scientists are just working pro bono. That if this becomes a reality and patients can benefit, the Brazilian federal government is basically going to pay for it for each one of the Brazilian paraplegics that need it.
Well, I don't see that happening here in the United States.
No, it's not going to happen
but
like that
here. But it
seems
like we are talking about medicine and these great strides in medicine that are available to the people who have access to it, but still those who are indigent, not so much.
Yes. Well, our hope is to create, in the future, not now, a version of this technology that would be affordable. You know, I think it can be done at the moment because the demand is very large. You know, you have
like a PC.
Sort of like a laptop, yeah. That would be the dream.
All right. Well, to hear more about the dream is going to be tonight at the San Antonio Country Club, courtesy of the Mind Science Foundation. Dr. Miguel Nicolás, he is the director of the Nicolás Lab at Duke University Medical Center. Thank you for joining us here on The Source.